This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For most of this week, last Saturday's White House Correspondents' Dinner was still causing indigestion.
And I'm never really sure what to call Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You know, is it Sarah Sanders? Is it Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Is it Cousin Huckabee? Is it Auntie Huckabee Sanders? Like, what's Uncle Tom but for white women who disappoint other white women? Oh, I know, Ann Coulter.
That was comedian Michelle Wolf, and it was one of her gentler jokes, which sent the political right exactly where you'd expect it would send them. Here's Fox quoting a Donald Trump tweet on the subject.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner is dead as we know it. Total disaster and embarrassment to our great country and all that it stands for. Fake news is alive and well and beautifully represented on Saturday night.
Now, as we've long complained, the Correspondents' Dinner is appalling on many levels, and Wolf's set was for sure an anti-Trump tirade. But it wasn't news, fake or otherwise. It was comedy, which is, different. Thing is, though, the disgust was not confined to the White House or the conservative ragosphere.
But Wolf took on, among other things, Sanders' appearance. Some found that offensive, including NBC's Andrea Mitchell, who's calling for an apology. So, too, is NBC's Mika Brzezinski, who said...
And then the Correspondents' Association threw their political comedy headliner under the bus.
Saying last night's program was meant to offer a unifying message. Unfortunately, the entertainer's monologue was not in the spirit of the mission.
To NYU professor and media critic Jay Rosen, it was just the latest example of a press corps shrugging off attacks on free speech and their own legitimacy. The president is calling them enemies of the people, but, you know, do you have to take everything so seriously?
Politico did a big survey about what it's like to report on the White House, and the theme of it was that, yeah, there are all these attacks on journalists, but actually the press is having a ball because there are so many amazing stories and so many great sources, and everybody wants to dish dirt on everyone else. And Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times and in many ways the dean of White House reporting, said all presidents are grumpy about their press treatment. And Donald Trump may be a little louder, but it's really no different than what we've seen in the past, an attitude I disagree strongly with. And Jack Schaefer says, sure, there's a lot of bluster and there's a lot of threats, and that would be disturbing if any of it happened, but we haven't really seen an opening up of the libel laws, and we haven't really seen journalists carted off to jail. And so what this war with journalists really is more like a pantomime. It's a ritual warfare in which everybody pretends to be really upset, but they're actually kind of collaborating in the production of this conflict.
I can see how the press just would want to stay out of the fray, to keep its head down, stick to its knitting.
Yeah.
But there also seems to be a sort of Monty Python Black Knight aspect to all of this. You haven't hurt me. It's a mere flesh wound.
Yeah.
Now, Trump hasn't locked anyone up yet or loosened up the libel laws, whatever that was supposed to mean. But is this just a flesh wound?
Well, I understand where they're coming from on that. On the surface, everything is fine, right? Journalism is operating. But if you were able to go out beyond Washington, you would discover some very disturbing facts. For example, a Texas newspaper editor I've talked to tells me every time he runs something from the New York Times or Washington Post News Service in his newspaper, he hears from subscribers who are enraged that journalism from the Times or the Post would appear in their newspaper. Just yesterday, I had a conversation on Twitter, a public conversation with a reporter from the Bay Area of California, who said, every day I see public officials closing the door on me, refusing to answer my questions, dismissing me as fake news. There have been, of course, incidents of violence against journalists. I think we'll probably see more of them. And so this attitude that I can still do my job and everything's pretty much the same for me is just a little blinkered.
There's blinkers. There's institutional denial, maybe, or maybe institutional impotence. There also may be more discouragingly seems to be a kind of a beet-sweetening aspect to all of this.
Yeah.
You know, if you go wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we see what you're up to, Mr. President, you rascal, in order to kind of suck up to him, that's worse than simply not recognizing the threat. You were particularly stunned by the voices of disapproval from some in the press over the comedy routine by Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
People who support real journalism, who patronize it by subscribing and who read it and consume the product and who think it's important that it survive, were agog that journalists would be apologizing to Sarah Huckabee Sanders considering her daily performance from the podium. One thing that might be going on here is that Republican office holders and elites kind of roll their eyes at some of Trump's more exaggerated attacks on the news media. But they want to deal with reporters who are sympathetic to them. And one way a Washington reporter can show establishment Republicans, hey, I'm not like those hysterics in the press, therefore you should come to me with your stories, is to kind of look down on this critique. Say, there's no real problem here. There's no big deal with Trump's attacks on the news media. It's mostly just theater. It's just for show. And you can see how that is a beet sweetener. It's a message to Republicans. Hey, I'm a reasonable person. You can deal with me.
Trump has taken this strategy of attacking the Fourth Estate to other important institutions, the Justice Department, the intelligence community, the judiciary. Do you think it dawn on the American people, even the 30% of hardcore Trump supporters, that the guy is simply trying to raise doubt about everybody who would find fault with him?
I think that's a very disturbing part of this development. One of the reasons why journalists saying, ha-ha, it's just for show, are, in my view, being incredibly complacent is the links between his attacks on the news media and the put-down of expertise in the State Department, the attack on the intelligence community, the attack on elections themselves and calling them rigged, and the attacks on anybody who is kind of evidence-based and therefore can show resistance to Trump's rhetoric and his impulses. Will Americans wake up to that? I don't know, because one of our two political parties has kind of sold its soul to the attack on knowledgeable elites. That's the way the Republican Party generates traction. It's the way it mobilizes its voters. It's built in. It's a structural feature. And so I don't know. It's one of the big doubts I have about the democracy I'm living in.
I'm obliged to ask you, because you are no doubt well aware that this show itself has vacillated between warning America of the approaching Trump Category 6 storm and trying not to be this week's anti-Trump screed.
Yeah.
I don't know that we pull any punches, but we try not to become a caricature of anti-Trump criticism and to lose credibility by doing that. What's the answer for the On the Media program, on which you are a frequent guest?
Well, I've thought about that a lot, and the best answer I have is that we should not become opponents of Trump himself, but opponents of what he's doing to our institutions and of a political style that erodes those institutions. And I don't know exactly how that translates into practice, but I think the start of wisdom is there.
Jay, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
NYU Professor Jay Rosen blogs at pressthink.org.
Coming up, the online universe where aggrieved men go to vent, a.k.a. the manosphere.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After the Toronto van attack last month, a new term has the media trying to make sense of a motive.
The man who killed 10 people with a van in Toronto this week was preoccupied by his status as an incel.
Short for involuntary celibates.
It's an online community frustrated with their romantic lives with women.
It cast a new and more frightening light on the so-called manosphere, a complex agglomeration of websites, blogs, and chat rooms united in the view that men, predominantly white men, are under attack. The manosphere includes a wide range of responses to that, from fathers' rights groups to tips on pickup artistry to the so-called Proud Boys, a far-right fraternity that restricts self-pleasuring to once a month, to Men Going Their Own Way, or MGTOW, whose website abounds with contempt for women and the civil society that's empowered them. But the manosphere also has spawned an unlikely hero, Jordan Peterson.
In the past 2 years, the Canadian psychologist and academic has been adopted as a hero of the Donald Trump-loving alt-right.
Perhaps, but essentially, he's just a conservative self-help guru, motivated neither by hate or fear. How do we sort out the different spaces and thought leaders that offer refuge to aggrieved men? First, we call Will Sommer, who explores conservative media in his newsletter, Right Richter. Will, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start by defining some terms? What's an incel? How do they fit into the alt-right puzzle?
Incel is short for involuntarily celibate. It's people, mostly men, who are not having sex and they're really mad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sort of weaponize this into some really truly toxic misogyny and anger at the world.
And you find these people where?
Some particularly slimy internet forums. On 4chan, for example, or they were recently kicked off of Reddit.
Is the pickup artist community a subset of this?
There are two branches of the same issue. You're talking about guys who are not getting the romantic relationships or sexual relationships that they would like. In the case of pickup artistry, this was a big thing maybe a decade ago. You know, these guys thought there's this cheat code essentially to get women. And then when they found that you can't just wear some gaudy jewelry to a bar and your entire life's going to change, this hope curdled into anger and misogyny. And that's how we got incels. The pickup artist movement has also become very focused on this idea that women control society and drastic measures up to violence are called for. The prototypical angry incel is Elliot Roger, who went on a rampage in California a few years ago.
The incel community only represents one direction for aggrieved young men and only one small part of the manosphere, right? We also have...
Yes.
Jordan Peterson, a psychology professor at the University of Toronto. And he advocates a different kind of message to his mostly white male audience on YouTube.
For 10 years, if you didn't avoid doing what you knew you needed to do, what would you be like?
Yeah, so Jordan Peterson has what is certainly, compared to incels, a much more positive message. They're both answering the question, why are... They're these young men often living with their parents and they don't have a direction in life. So what do you do with them? Incels would say society is skewed against us and just get really mad about it. Jordan Peterson, he's positioned himself as this internet father figure. And so he has catchphrases that are clean your room, bucko, kind of like get out there and get some stuff done.
I don't think that young men hear words of encouragement, some of them never in their entire lives, as far as I can tell. That's what they tell me. And the fact that I've been speaking, the YouTube lectures that I've done and put online, for example, have had such a dramatic impact is an indication that young men are starving for this sort of message.
His book about getting your life together is a New York Times bestseller. He gets millions of views on YouTube. He's a very prominent figure. And with Jordan Peterson, there's kind of like two tracks. There's the get your life together part, and then there's a part that appeals to, I think, a lot of young right-wing men. He's very anti-political correctness. He has these viral videos where he's kind of going up against a liberal and defeating them with logic or what have you.
Diversity, inclusivity, equity, all of those things together in particular make up a very toxic group.
You might think of a classic Jordan Peterson fan or someone who's really attracted to this as someone who is being told all the time, well, you're white, you're a man, like you have all the advantages, but their lives are not going the way they would like. The question is, well, why is that? Well, maybe you blame the left and you blame minorities. Or Jordan Peterson offers the alternative of, well, perhaps men have been, you know, sort of twisted away from their natural nature. Let's put this sort of heroic idea and kind of get back to it.
Now, you were saying there are really two parts to Peterson's attraction, the life coach part, and also the anti-PC part. The anti-PC part conjures up red pilling, you know, from Reddit, seeing the world clearly in a way that everyone else seems to be blinded to.
So a lot of these Jordan Peterson fans, they're young men, very fixated on the supposed strictures of feminism and identity politics. A big Jordan Peterson thing is criticism of identity politics. He's very fixated on issues of campus speech, stuff like that. And of course, whenever campus liberals overreach or do something ridiculous, that's something that gets very popular on the right-wing internet. Jordan Peterson has in part made his name by standing up against that.
By being a free thinker.
Yes, exactly.
Free thinking. This is something that Kanye West, on his recent journey, invoked.
I'ma do me. I was in the sunken place and then I found a new me. Not worried about some image that I gotta keep up. A lot of people agree with me, but they too scared to speak up. The greater good.
This has become part of the whole ideology, hasn't it? I mean, Jeet here in the New Republic recently observed that Kanye, despite voicing right-wing ideas, choose the idea of conservative in favor of free thinker, and that it's a common trope in certain circles on the right where reactionary ideas are recast as radical inquiry, and those who dare criticize such inquiry are accused of silencing free speech. Is that overly reductive or an accurate reflection?
I think it's true that conservatism, as we've known it, perhaps from the Reagan administration or what Paul Ryan represents, I think is losing steam in terms of appealing to people. Your other options are Trumpism, or you present it as sort of this forbidden thing that it's cool to get into. For example, a popular claim made by people on InfoWars is that
conservatism is the new counterculture.
We've seen that appeals to Kanye. And it's also something that Jordan Peterson offers, you know, being this intellectual outlaw.
Who are his ideological peers? I mean, how do we situate his thinking in the broadly shifting right and also within the manosphere?
Jordan Peterson fits in with a lot of other people who talk a lot about free thinking or being a classical liberal, stuff like that. Dave Rubin, Stefan Molyneux, and then there's also—
Did you say a classical liberal?
They don't want to identify as conservatives or Republicans because that's kind of a tired brand. And it's also one that doesn't really appeal to a lot of young people. So you describe yourself as a classical liberal. Free speech is your main issue, and it's also a political constituency that doesn't exist outside of YouTube. So it's very easy to constantly be shape-shifting in terms of your actual politics or your policy beliefs. A lot of times when I describe Jordan Peterson or a figure like him as a conservative, people on the right will say, you fool, he's a classical liberal, as though that means anything.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't like it when he's called a member of the alt-right, and really, there's no reason to lump him with the alt-right, the alt-right now being a synonym for a white supremacist.
During the Trump campaign, there were a lot of people who weren't racist who identified themselves as alt-right. Certainly, there were a lot of white supremacist members of the alt-right. But since 2017, and especially since Charlottesville, we've seen non-racist or anti-Semitic members of the alt-right fall away and try to redefine themselves in other ways. A lot of them are called alt-light. Or they describe themselves as the new right. I would say it's unfair to describe Jordan Peterson as a member of the alt-right, because right now that essentially means like David Duke.
He could be located on what some people call the intellectual dark web, right?
Yeah, the intellectual dark web is a term a lot of these figures describe themselves as, or their fans see them this way. This comes from the actual dark web, which is a difficult to access portion of the internet where it's hard to trace things. You know, it might be where drug deals go down, for example.
Yeah, it's associated with criminal activity.
Exactly. So they're appealing to this kind of forbidden nature of the knowledge they're discussing. These are the ideas too dangerous to exist on the actual web or within the mainstream intellectual discourse. And so you have to kind of dig for this stuff.
So how should we understand all of this in relation to the manosphere? Incels, men going their own way, or the proud boys who conserve their precious bodily essence, and so on?
If the question is, what do we do with all these men in the modern world who are having difficulty fitting into life, essentially? For men going their own way, they would say that society sort of shackles men with things like marriage and children. And so, you know, I'm going to go lead this ostensibly hedonistic lifestyle. In the case of incels, they say society is irreversibly against us and either get mad about it online and just kind of stew or commit acts of violence. In the case of Jordan Peterson, he says that there is a way for men to make their way in the world, and here are the strictures and structures by which to do it. And in the case of Proud Boys, they say men need fraternal companionship, and we're going to have this men's organization that also gets in a lot of street fights and has rules about masturbating.
Okay, so as we observed, there are a lot of people in the media who sort of lump Peterson into the alt-right, and that's just not correct. So how do you think, in general, the media are reading the right-wing ecosystem that we've discussed and within it, the manosphere?
I think there's not a lot of familiarity with these issues and these figures, so that then when they spill out into the news, whether that be because Jordan Peterson has a best-selling book or because an incel went on a rampage, I think there's a tendency to lump all of these people together as the right. And there are a lot of different strands, often warring strands. I think the media often blurs the lines between these different groups. And frankly, it's to their benefit when the media does this, because then people who are familiar with this stuff, maybe their followers or what have you, they see and they say, oh my gosh, the people in the media don't know what they're talking about. And it further ties these people to this alternative media structure.
Right. Saying, well, if they get this wrong, think of what else they get wrong.
Exactly.
Will, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Will Sommer is an editor at The Hill and writes a newsletter about conservative media called Right Richter. So we've made a start in sorting out the spaces, but haven't yet considered the men who inhabit them and the history that forged them. For that, we need a historian and sociologist, someone who focuses on masculinity. We found one.
So masculinity studies, which is what I would call it, I guess, is a subfield of gender studies.
Michael Kimmel is a professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University.
Gender studies, of course, is the sort of expansion of women's studies from the 70s and 80s. Women's studies made women visible. It went back into history and literature and said, you know, we've really got to rediscover some of the great women artists and writers and poets and historical figures. But it also made gender visible. We became aware that gender is one of the organizing principles of social life, that gender is one of the foundations of your identity. Women and men and others who began to sort of say, well, what about men's lives? Let's talk about how men's lives are gendered. A similar process was going on around what we came to call critical whiteness studies. People said, well, what does it mean to be white?
Yeah, by particularizing whiteness rather than seeing it as a default, or men rather than seeing it as a default, you otherize it in a good way, like everything else is otherized. You see it against a backdrop that isn't just itself.
Exactly right. Making the center visible as just one other identity. So, for example, if you were to take a course on 19th century British literature, when you talked about the Brontes or when you talked about Jane Austen, you would, of course, talk about gender. But when you talked about Dickens, Dickens is a social problem novelist, so of course he only talked about class, despite the fact that if you look at his longest books, they were all books about young boys looking for authentic fathers, like Oliver Twist or David Copperfield. Those are also meditations about masculinity.
Between the alt-right men at Charlottesville and the perpetrators of school shootings and other mass violence, and Kanye West bemoaning what he sees as constraints on his freedom of thought. Something is coalescing that feels new, but is it?
I published a book in 2013 called Angry White Men. I've been studying the extreme right and other groups of men who feel aggrieved. And the phrase that I came up with is aggrieved entitlement. My first encounter with these guys came about 15 years ago on a TV talk show. Four white men who believed that they were the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of that show was a quote from one of the men, "A black woman stole my job." And so when it was my turn to speak, I just said, "I have one question for you guys about the title of this show, A Black Woman Stole My Job. Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why isn't it like a black woman got the job?" Now, what's interesting to me about this particular historical moment is there's a large swath of white men who believe that they are the victims of reverse discrimination. There is also a country that has come to believe that they have been victimized. I grew up, Brooke, believing that the United States was basically the biggest, baddest bully on the block. Now you hear Donald Trump saying, "No, we're the victims. China's taking advantage of us. NATO, the UN, the
They're
EU,
laughing
we're
at
the
us.
Victims. We have to regain our swagger." And of course, Trump, every single day, tweets how he is the victim of a witch hunt. And so all three of these, Trump the man, the U.S. as a country, and this aggrieved entitlement among angry white men, are all coalescing in this particular moment.
So you're distinguishing between aggrieved entitlement and garden variety misogyny and domestic violence, which we've had with us forever.
I think that they're connected. Many of the men who batter their wives or partners don't usually talk about it as the initiation of aggression. They talk about it as revenge, as retaliation.
"She made me do it.
You didn't have dinner ready. What did you expect?" So in that sense, it has a similar kind of rhetoric. But the traditional way that we've understood it is that these are individual, isolated cases. And now what we see with the development of the manosphere and all these Reddit fora, et cetera, is a development of communities of men who are supporting each other, encouraging each other, egging each other on in their sense of righteous victimization.
So do you think that element of aggrieved political entitlement led by Donald Trump, does that aggrieved entitlement fuel the personal kind?
What I'm saying is that there are connections between them. This is speculation. I don't think there's ever been a study of the Reddit communities. But most of the men's rights guys, most of the red pill guys, the men going their own way, my suspicion is they would be centrist Democrats.
Why? Why would you think that?
I've interviewed quite a number of them, the men's rights guys. You know, they feel uncomfortable with Trump's policies because they see Trump's policies favoring the super rich over the ordinary American, although they do like the sense of entitlement to women's bodies.
So how do they square that circle?
My sense is that they don't. They run on parallel tracks.
Yes. The van driver in Toronto cited Elliot Rodger, who was famously in one of these extreme groups. Rodger killed people after leaving a video suicide note about how he was destined to die a virgin. And he references a guy named George Sedini, who walked into an aerobic studio in Pennsylvania and killed women. And that was 2009?
2009, yeah.
Yeah.
So yes, every few years, there has been a guy who believes himself to be a good-looking, clean-cut, white guy, entitled to sex. George Sedini says, "I haven't had sex in 10 years. You owe me. I'm angry." Now, Elliot Rodger, he didn't reference Sodini, but he did the same thing in Santa Barbara. He said, "You know, I'm much nicer and better looking than all those guys that you're sleeping with. I'm going to get my revenge." Al Sarian in Toronto referenced Elliot Rodger. So I think we have these sporadic events that otherwise wouldn't have been connected to some kind of larger movement. But with the advent of all of these Reddit fora and the internet, they now feel like they have a community. I think when these guys actually act out like this, the members of those communities probably face some kind of anguish. Like, well, I understand why he did it, but I wouldn't do that. But what binds them together, what unites them, it seems to me, is this sense that as men in this culture, they deserve sex. And part of that is that we have constructed sexuality, the sexual relations between women and men, as a kind of adversarial sport. If I get some and you give it up, I win and you lose. It's a zero-sum game. So if I don't get it, I feel like a loser. 20 years ago, if you were what we would now call an incel, that is involuntarily celibate, you'd be self-medicating with drugs or alcohol. You'd be sitting around just sort of moping, or you'd be trying to get out there and keep going to singles bars and keep trying. But you would feel alone. Now, when I put out into cyberspace my anguish, someone writes back and says, oh, I feel your pain, man. I get it. And suddenly you have a brother.
How do you feel that the extreme incidents have been covered?
On the one hand, you have to report the motives of these particular actors when they do these horrific things. If it's a white person, we think, well, they were mentally ill. If it was, you know, a person of color, we think it's something in their culture or their religion, mm-hmm. because that's how racism works. Mm-hmm. You know, racism disaggregates white people but aggregates people of color. You have an obligation to cover their motives. On the other hand, you also know that there will be people who go, wow, that's how I've been feeling. I didn't know there was a word for it.
You also think, though, that the focus on these big incidents might lead we in the media to miss the legitimate anguish at the core of some right-wing thought. For example, we have a clip here from Tucker Carlson from Fox. He had this recurring segment a couple of months ago called What is Happening to Men?
Women on average are scoring higher on IQ tests than men are. Even physically, men are falling behind. A recent study found that almost half of young men failed the Army's entry-level physical fitness exam during basic training. Even as women far outpace men in higher education, for example, virtually every college campus supports a women's studies department whose core goal is to attack male power. Men seem to be becoming less male. Sperm counts, for example, across the West have plummeted. They're down almost 60% since the early 1970s. Scientists don't know why this is. Nothing like this has ever happened to a population this big. American men are failing in body, in mind, and in spirit. This is a crisis.
It is true that girls and women are outpacing boys and men in college and in high school and middle school. 75% of high school valedictorians last year were girls. But even though 60% of all college students are female, more people are going to college than ever before. The rate of increase among girls is greater and faster than the rate of increase among boys. Mm-hmm. But there are more boys in school today than there were 30 years ago. So it's not like boys are vanishing. But here's the other side of that. He does point out there are many men who are in pain. When I interviewed the white nationalists, I heard that same refrain over and over again. They were badly done by. They were hurt. They were angry. I think that they were right. But what I wanted to say to them is, do you really think that it was immigrants who gave them those predatory loans? Was it LGBT people who caused climate change? Was it feminist women who outsourced their jobs? My feeling is they're right to be angry, but they're delivering their mail to the wrong address.
What about these women's studies departments whose core goal is to attack male power?
It's a certain kind of male narcissism to think that women's studies courses are preoccupied with men. In fact, what they're preoccupied with is women. It is true that women have identified that in our society, what gender inequality means is the power of men over women, and also the power of some men over other men. You can't just talk about men and women, but which men exactly? You know, the power of some men, white men, over men of color, class, ethnicity, religion, age, all of these are the ways in which some men dominate other men. So yes, of course, they're interested in power, but they really have better things to do than just talk about their gripes about men.
Point taken. I just wonder, do you think, as a gender studies professor with a specialty in masculinities, you might offer a solution on college campuses as a complement to women-centered gender studies classes?
The real solution would be not to have separate masculinity studies programs, but rather to integrate into our literature courses, our history courses, the fact that not only were women working out issues around gender, but so were men. After the Republican primaries, where we were constantly talking about the size of people's hands, mm-hmm. it became very clear that this was a whole exercise about who's the real man.
Michael, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke. Good to talk to you.
Michael Kimmel is a professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University. His latest book is called Healing from Hate. It's about how white men get out of the white supremacy movement.
Coming up, peace, love, and mass poisoning. How thousands of followers of an Indian guru made a play for the state of Oregon.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the 6-part documentary series Wild, Wild Country came out on Netflix last month, it was like a blast from an unremembered past. Back in the early 80s, thousands of followers of the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh descended on an Oregon ranch the size of Tallahassee, Florida, to found their utopia. The Rajneeshis had millions of dollars and a lifestyle based on meditation, consciousness raising, and free love. It was all irresistible to their young American and European followers, and increasingly alarming to their closest neighbors in the tiny town of Antelope, population 40. What followed was an epic struggle between the Rajneeshis and every level of government. That struggle involved elections, a relentless media campaign, arson, a mass poisoning, political assassination attempts, and the recruitment of more than 5,000 homeless people from around the country. We won't talk much about that. No spoilers here, but there's plenty we can say. McLean and Chapman Way directed Wild Wild Country. Hey, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having us. We're excited.
Thanks for having us on, Bob.
This is a wild, wild story. These people, all dressed in varying shades of red, came to Oregon, to this barren land, and they built their own city, including streets, waterworks, public transportation, shopping centers, houses, police force, even an airstrip, and then chaos ensues. And you have the entire story from every angle on tape. How did that happen?
Yeah, luckily news directors in the Portland area, I think they knew what a significant historical story the Rajneeshis were and the story of Rajneesh Purim. So they kept all their raw tapes, which was incredibly rare because we weren't just working with what ended up on the nightly news every night. We were working with what the cameramen who drove down to the ranch shot, and that ended up being 300 hours of archive footage. And then the group themselves, the Rajneeshis, they would edit these ranch promo documentaries 10 to 15 minutes long that we had gotten access to. So we literally almost had footage for everything we wanted to tell.
There are a lot of characters in this story. There's the Bhagwan himself in flowing robes. There's his secretary, kind of a chief of staff and spokeswoman, a tiny and very feisty young woman named Ma Anand Sheila.
Free sex, we don't charge for it, if you mean that.
Right.
There were a few extraordinarily eloquent followers who you spent hours interviewing.
I approached Devaraj and said something into his ear. And as he leaned towards me, I pushed the syringe.
Some nearly as eloquent local town folk in Antelope.
They all had something that we referred to as the look, almost like under the influence.
Some really determined politicians and prosecutors.
We had no idea that we were going to run into the largest poisoning case in the history of the United States.
It's often very difficult to identify the protagonists.
Yeah, exactly. We were exhilarated by this idea that most of our audience are going to come with little familiarity with the story. And probably at one point they're going to start leaning on maybe one person's perspective or one side's perspective. But hopefully 10, 15 minutes later, as you're hearing new information, you're questioning the position you just took. And I think we are interested in doing that, not just for the sake of being objective, although that's nice, but we actually thought that was an entertaining kind of way to structure the series, which is audience members doing kind of detective work, not in terms of whodunit, but where do I draw the line on who's good and bad in the story? And what is the difference between cult and religion? And where do I determine my moral compass on the difference between right and wrong?
Now, if peaceful coexistence between Rajneeshpuram and Antelope was the original goal for everybody, it sure didn't last long.
The Rajneesh have taken over. They'll make the state red if somebody doesn't do something to stop them.
Which triggered most of the craziness that was to follow.
This is Chapman speaking. When we started doing research, we found that the first real line that was drawn in the sand between these two groups was over land use. They didn't know this, but other than Hawaii, Oregon had the most strict land use laws in the country. And the plot of land that they bought, the Big Muddy Ranch that was 64,000 acres, was zoned for exclusive farm use only, which limited what kind of buildings you could have on there, how many houses you could have on the property. And so very early on, the co-founder of Nike, Bill Bowerman, who shared a property line with this commune, starts putting together this legal defense with an environmental group called Thousand Friends of Oregon to dismantle the city. And for this group who had just spent $125 million building their utopia, they saw it as an act of survival to go into the closest town to them, which was Antelope, which was 19 miles away, and buy up all the for sale property, move in their own followers to their community, and then they would therefore be able to take over political control of the town, which would allow them incorporation rights, which would allow them to build their businesses, would allow them to have their church there in town. And so they moved over 60 followers into this very conservative cowboy ranching town of Antelope and basically took it over.
One of the interesting parallels that we found in the series was, on first glance, the cultural divide between these groups is so vast, but Antelope was a very religious town that had transformed their barren wasteland into their little city, and they had a church right in the middle of town and had prayer and public school, and these are by and large frontier townsfolk that aren't looking for handouts or the pull yourself up by your bootstraps type people, and the Rajneeshis wanted their own city with their church right in the middle of it and wanted to practice their way of life.
Another place we see competing narratives is the question of religious liberty. Once the Rajneeshis did amass political power in Antelope, they were in a position to use local institutions, the schools, the police, whatever, in service of their community. And the Antelopians, therefore, argued that the Rajneeshis were violating the separation of church and state.
The school is permeated with religious symbolism. It did not look, sound, or feel like a public school.
But then you hear the Bhagwan's lawyer point out that that problem doesn't seem to apply to Mormons in Utah or Catholics in Boston.
You know, most Americans are familiar with the separation of church and state, but mostly to keep religion out of government. It's actually a two-sided coin. It's also to prevent government intrusion on religious rights. And so the local Oregonians and the government see this as a tool to get rid of this guru. And it is a very convincing argument that they give. They have a public school, but all the teachers dress in religious garb. They teach the religious teachings of their guru. Is that really a public school? And by being an incorporated city, it gave them their own police force and access to police database information that should be protected. They have this very convincing argument that this religious group is violating the separation of church and state. But then you kind of get to flip the coin and you get to see it from the perspective inside this religious community, which is they feel that this is a complete government intrusion on their rights to assembly, their rights to freedom of religion.
Which we found fascinating because, you know, in episode one, Sheila will tell the audience, and certainly what she told us was she went to Montclair State University in New Jersey. So she had some experience in America, and she was always in love with the United States Constitution, especially because of its religious freedom protections. And I think that was a big reason why she felt America would be a great fit for Bhagwan, and for that to turn on her, and for her to see that the U.S. Constitution was now being used to strike at the heart of her community. that's when you really start to see things kind of ramp up, not just legal tensions, but it starts to spill over into physical violence.
We were less interested in confirming this is evil and more interested in exploring the devastation that can occur with ultimate devotion to one man and what can happen with tribalism.
One man or one woman. I mean, if there's exactly. a plain villain to emerge in this series, I suppose it's Ma Anand Sheela, this kind of charmingly pugnacious young woman turns sinister, to say the least. And she's got a little Iago, a little Rasputin, a little Cardinal Richelieu. And at one point, when she doesn't have enough votes to dominate a county election, she hatches a crazy scheme.
Yeah, so by episode 3, after this group has taken over the town of Antelope, they now set their sights on taking over the larger surrounding county called Wasco County. They know that they don't have enough people inside the commune to win these Wasco County elections, so they need to bolster their voting numbers. And they hatch this plan to bus in over 5,000 homeless people from the streets from all over America, Washington, D.C., Miami, Skid Row, and Los Angeles.
In Washington, D.C., the Rajneeshis continue to recruit street people with the promise of food and shelter and a free bus ride to Oregon.
Spoiler alert, doesn't work out that way.
It was bananas. She brought in voters, but she also brought in mental health issues, alcoholism, some criminality.
The other interesting dynamic that had emerged in our archive footage was a lot of these homeless people, they were Vietnam War veterans. And so in their own interviews from the 80s, they would oftentimes talk about the resentment that they felt towards America. You know, these people dressed in red, they were the first people that were offering them a helping hand. They loved it. They kind of were interested in voting and supporting this community. Yeah, suffice to say, it obviously doesn't work out that well. Jane, who is a Rajneeshi that was starting to break away from the movement, she would often call this the beginning of the end of Rajneeshpuram.
It was a catastrophe. We had literally thousands of homeless people causing complete chaos. It became clear that we had a hornet's nest right in the middle of the community.
Overnight, almost, there's a 2-to-1 ratio of homeless people to Rajneeshis. I think that it was beginning to open her eyes up that this isn't what we started here.
Let's just assume that the intention of all of the Rajneeshis was entirely pure. Let's assume that they were just good people who wanted to do something radical and utopian. And along the way, they encountered hostile land use regulations, inconvenient laws, unhappy neighbors, all of the realities of society. And even without the outside world, Rajneeshpuram couldn't even bear the weight of its own internal contradictions. What does this story tell us about the possibility for any utopian project to gain purchase in the modern world filled with other people?
You know, I think it's actually natural that these Antelopians were scared of these Rajneeshis that came into their town and dressed head to toe in one color and maybe armed themselves with AK-47s. I think that's like a natural fear that you have. But then, like, what do you do after that? That's what you're in control of. And the same goes for the Rajneeshis. It's like the anger that they must have felt when their community is being threatened over land use. They felt that they had transformed this wasteland into this utopian oasis. It must have caused an immense amount of rage and anger, but it's what you do after that. I think that Sheila's innate personality, Bhagwan's innate philosophy was provocation, was controversy. The Rajneeshis, when push came to shove, they certainly shoved harder than anyone else. And I think obviously on the Antelopians, it was the same sort of thing. You know, they were going to do whatever it took to get them out of town.
One final question. This is On the Media. And a hammer thinks everything is a nail. But I contend that this episode in the 80s in Oregon is at the core a media story. The Bhagwan captivated the media. Sheila mastered the media with her smile and her bluntness and her seeming never-ending press tour.
No, I'm not running for cover, mister. I don't run for cover. And person like you make me run for cover? That's a joke.
Video, as we discussed, was used as a defensive weapon by the Rajneeshis and as an intimidation tool as well. newsrooms worldwide followed every development, and yet so ephemeral. I mean, where did it go? 70 Rolls Royces, poisonings. How did it evaporate till now?
When we were making this series, everyone was kind of familiar with Jonestown and everyone was kind of familiar with Waco. And, you know, people would constantly ask us, like, how do I not remember this story or how do I not know about this story? And really, I think it was kind of a combination of factors. I think one, the fact that no one did die, which is remarkable considering the tension out there. There was no bloodshed in this story, which is why I think it kind of got lost to the dustbins of history. The other interesting thing is when we went through a lot of the media in the 80s, this story really was reported as just kind of this bizarre, quirky thing that was happening out in Eastern Oregon with this guy and these Rolls Royces. And no one was really diving into like the complexities of this story. And so I think by the time the commune disbanded in 1985, everyone was like, oh, that weird, quirky experiment is over. Documentary allows you to shine a light on these forgotten stories and re-examine what makes them so profound and what makes them so significant.
Chapman and McLean, thank you very much.
Great talking to you. Thanks for having us on.
Chapman and McLean Way are brothers and directors of Wild, Wild Country, available on Netflix. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Philip Yiannopoulos, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.